to the Young Members Corner, a podcast series brought to you by the Young Member Service of the American Head and Neck Society, where each episode we bring you topics of interest to the head and neck surgery community with a focus on cutting-edge research in head and neck oncology, controversies in head and neck surgery, and early career development. I'm your host, Andres Burr, and I'm a head and neck and microvascular surgeon at the University of Kansas.
And I'm your co-host, Larissa Sweeney. I did my residency at the University of Alabama in Birmingham and my fellowship at Thomas Jefferson University. I'm currently on faculty at LSU New Orleans.
And I'm Arvin Bhatti. I did my residency training at Mount Sinai in New York and completed my fellowship in head, neck, and microvascular surgery at the University of Cincinnati. I'm currently on faculty at the University of Massachusetts Chan Medical School. Welcome to our third episode. Today, we will be discussing some of the obstacles and adversities still faced by female head neck surgeons. Though significant progress has been made to eliminate, or at the very least, lessen such obstacles, it is undeniable that there's still more work to be done in our field. According to the AAMC's Physician Specialty Report, the percentage of female otolaryngologists has increased from 11.2% in 2008 to 18.3% in 2019. Though these numbers do reflect a significant increase in female representation within otolaryngology, there's still a significant lack of females in leadership positions, such as chairs of departments or residency program directors. We hope that today's episode will help to shed some light on why this is and what is actively being done to improve such inequities. Additionally, in today's episode, we discuss how young faculty might best navigate their newfound independence in their respective departments, as well as how to tackle some of the challenges faced by younger faculty, including starting a practice, raising a family, and how to advocate for oneself. Our guest today is Dr. Gina Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson is a professor of otolaryngology head and neck surgery at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. She specializes in head and neck surgical oncology, microvascular reconstruction, and transoral robotic surgery. Additionally, Dr. Jefferson is dedicated to mentoring females and underrepresented in medicine individuals to spark their interest as future otolaryngologists and head and neck surgeons.
Welcome, Dr. Jefferson.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me to participate.
So I want to jump right in. So there's really no question that in many fields in medicine and surgery, underrepresentation of women and minorities, particularly in leadership positions, is a real issue. This is particularly true in head neck reconstructive surgery, where there are many early career women who do head neck free flaps, but very few who are later in their careers. I wanted to get your thoughts on why you think so few women head neck surgeons continue to do free flaps later in their careers.
Well, I would like to hope that it's because as we women are more advanced in our careers, that we have other opportunities along the lines of leadership roles and administrative duties that kind of result in curtailing our practice to more of just the resection surgeon rather than taking on the added demands of being a microvascular surgeon. A lot of my female friends that are microvascular surgeons are, you know, along the same time period in their career as I am. So it's hard to know because we're all still doing microvascular. So the women that I do see that have kind of curtailed their practice, it's largely because they've been doing other leadership things.
Do you think that there are any barriers to continuing to do flaps other than sort of the career advancement, you know, getting up more opportunities? Are there challenges that you think are specific to women, you know, as they advance their careers?
It's hard to say. I am a microvascular surgeon. I'm married, but I don't have any children. And this probably comes up a lot in conversation, but I feel like perhaps it could be added demands of balancing kind of work as well as family life. But the flip side is that many of the successful microvascular surgeons that are female that I've seen have lots of help that enables them to, in effect, be successful in all of the roles of life, not just their career. So I can't really identify a systemic barrier to female successful microvascular surgeon off the top of my head.
So to kind of bounce off of that a little bit, as a male colleague that's kind of just starting in the field, I had a lot of conversations with my fellowship directors and other members within the field last year. And I found an interesting thing that I noticed, or it was mentioned to me by one of my mentors, is that as a male microvascular surgeon, say you're going to have a child, regardless of what your spouse does and you're planning to take some time off, I've found, or at least in some of my experience, seems that the male microvascular surgeon may not necessarily take as much time off in terms of what is allotted, what is allowed by the department, and what is kind of expected by their partners in their practice, in comparison to the female microvascular surgeon who, while a male partner or a male parent may have certain requirements to parenting, obviously being a female and being a mother requires a lot more time. And typically there's kind of an expected amount, or at least previously discussed amount of time that person can take off with their department within their practice. And they kind of have this communication with their partners. Do you find that, for example, I'll just give you an example. Say you have a male microvascular surgeon, a female microvascular surgeon, they both end up having children, and the male microvascular surgeon takes 2 weeks off and then comes back to do a couple add-on cases, starts bringing his practice back, within 2 to 3 weeks. In comparison, the female microvascular surgeon takes, I guess, let's say the department allotted 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so, and then kind of couples that with some additional vacation time and stuff of that nature. Do you feel like that itself already kind of creates a little bit of inequity in that? Do you feel like as a male within the field, we should also be fighting to take an equivalent amount of time, to realize that is the expectation, so to speak, when having a child, regardless of your sex or your parental role?
I mean, in 2021, I would hope personally that male or female new parent is supported in whatever decision they make with respect to how much time they need to bond with their child. And so I think that we, where I practice, are residents are indeed supported with respect to time off, whether they're male or female, when they have a child. And I hope the same holds true for faculty members, because how else can you maintain a well-positioned workforce if their family life is not supported and only encouraged for more productivity clinically?
I kind of asked because when I was looking through my contract at UMass, I kind of asked specifically about paternity leave, and I had to go through some weeds to kind of find out the actual legal jargon that existed within the contract. And then, you know, with ACJME and with laws within the state of Massachusetts, things have changed where there's kind of a designated time. But I do wonder, and I did talk to some other female microsurgeon mentors that did mention that, you know, you end up in this strange situation where you may want to take a significant amount of time that is rightfully yours and allotted to you, but your partner within a similar practice, or even within the same, just within another faculty member within the institution that's male, may take 2 weeks or so. And then when you're kind of looking at the overhead and looking at the department global picture, you kind of start to see, you know, should we be advocating more for kind of a more universal, let's say, child leave or something of that nature, to make it more consistent so that one provider versus another isn't, you know, compared in that way.
Right, because the resident rules are clear. Yep. About the amount of time male and female can have off. But obviously as a faculty member, that's gonna vary from hospital to hospital, state to state. I will say I had a close friend in our community that does microvascular that had significant pushback when she wanted to take leave for the appropriate time that's actually allotted in her contract. And I was proud of her for standing up for herself and saying that this is what I need and what's best for me and my family.
Yeah.
And obviously she still has her job, but it should never be like that. From my perspective, I think that everyone should be supported in their family building and work life and not punished for wanting to have a family outside of medicine.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, thinking back to when I had my second child, which was during my time here at KU, I ended up taking a week off and then kind of eased back into it in the second week, which is in hindsight was a very short period of time. But it, you know, it's hard. There's the time that you're allotted, and then there's the kind of the pressure from you know, building case volumes from partners who are, you know, picking up the extra volume while you're away. So I think it's a hard decision, and there are a lot of factors that play into it.
I think that we are really hard on ourselves. I transitioned from Chicago to where I am now in 2017. And when I got here, I was told by my physician that I needed to have a surgical procedure that would entail me being off for 6 to 8 weeks. I just think as surgeons, we are so in the trenches, like, I can't do that. People need me. My patients need me. I'm building this practice, whatever it is. And we just put things off for so long because we literally are thinking these people need us, which they do, but, you know, to what end? Because if we're not well, we cannot take care of our patients to the best of our abilities. So we really need to pay more attention to our own well-being ultimately, because we're the only ones that know how we're feeling emotionally, how we are, how much stress that we're enduring. And if your family life is not good and you're feeling guilty about not spending that time with your newborn or whatever the event may be, these things all add up over time.
Just to shift gears a little bit, Gina, for those of the listeners that maybe don't know your story, how did you end up on a path that took you to microvascular? Was there a particular mentor that was influential, or just love the procedure? Kind of how did your journey bring you to this place?
Oh, that's funny because it's so convoluted. Well, I was actually a categorical general surgery resident. I had no idea that I was going to fall in love with otolaryngology. Not every medical school has a curriculum where you're exposed to otolaryngology. So I was not really exposed to it until I became a general surgery resident. The program that I was in, there were no subspecialty residency programs. There was orthopedics, there was general surgery. And so we basically covered subspecialty call because there were attendings for cardiothoracic surgery, plastic surgery, and otolaryngology. And as a one, you were exposed to otolaryngology to get the endocrine experience, but of course that's not all otolaryngologists do. And I fell in love with a laryngectomy patient. So my first exposure that was significant was a cancer patient. And I was so intrigued by otolaryngology that as a second year afterwards, my second otolaryngology rotation, I took the year off, did research, actually applied to otolaryngology, and that's how I got into otolaryngology. I tried to maintain an open mind to the other subspecialties of otolaryngology. I always came back to the head and neck cancer patient, and with more exposure to head and neck and microvascular reconstruction, it was just, that's what I had to do. I love the opportunity of having a long-term relationship with a patient and their family, celebrating patients that are cured. And for me, I absolutely love the challenge of reconstruction because every defect is different. Even every simple oral cavity defect is different in some way. And so that's the challenge that I love. And 12 years in, I still love it.
Well, that brings me to my other question. Do you see yourself, you know, sometimes, as you mentioned earlier, when people take on more administrative roles, they drop one or the other, and male or female, it seems most commonly people drop the recon. Have you given any thought to what trajectory your future might take you? Do you have a preference towards recon or the ablative side?
Ooh, that one's hard. I love them both. I love the challenge of achieving a R0 resection. So, I mean, I would not be able to choose right now. I don't know.
Well, it's good to hear that it's more the you love both of them as opposed to lifestyle. I think sometimes as a younger faculty member looking ahead, it seems that lifestyle of a recon surgeon might sway someone to take a more ablative role as their admin responsibilities increased. I don't know if that's your experience watching other people that are a little bit further along in their career, but that's kind of the perspective it seems from my point of view.
That's probably what I've viewed as well. I don't know. I just feel like all along, I haven't really been so overburdened by high volume microvascular. Like when I was in Chicago, I was the only person doing microvascular in my institution. I probably did 40 free flaps in a year. And so for me, that's fantastic. It's an even balance. And so I've never been at a place, well, I can't say never, but not long-term in a place where I was so overwhelmed by the number of free flaps I was doing. There was one point here where 3 free flaps a week is a lot for me. And so just my head can't take it. So in order to maintain the right frame of mind without being overly stressed, the maximum I'm willing to do in a week is 2. And so since it's pretty much been that way for me my entire career, I don't see the stress of a microvascular surgeon life as something that I wouldn't be able to handle at the same time I'm in a leadership role. That's how I feel now. It could all change. I don't know.
Yeah. I was going to say, Larissa, just, you know, to your point of, you know, what do you kind of consider as you gain more administrative responsibilities, you know, whether it's you stick with the reconstructive side of things or the ablative. I mean, I think there are challenges on both sides. And I've seen, you know, senior head neck reconstructive surgeons who've, you know, who haven't given up the reconstructive part of their practice because there is some flexibility there. If you're just the reconstructive surgeon, you have your, you know, you often have your mornings free and that allows you some flexibility. And then, you know, just the, I think the emotional toll of treating head neck cancer, just seeing patients who, you know, despite your best efforts, despite doing everything right, recur and die of their disease. I mean, I think there are different sides of it. And I think just, you know, from a psychological and wellness standpoint, I think different head neck surgeons seem to take different paths.
I have one more follow-up question. Sorry, you mentioned that in Chicago, you were the only person doing recon. How was that a difficult adjustment for you? Or did you have mentors you could reach out to? Who did you kind of lean on if you had any questions or wanted to bounce ideas off of somebody?
Primarily my friend Lisa. People that I think you build a community of trusted colleagues where you can share bad experiences. No one's going to judge you. You can just share those experiences to learn from their experiences how you might do something better or different in the future. So obviously in fellowship, you have some really good mentors that you have spent close thousands of hours with. So probably those are key components of your community, but you meet people at conferences, you meet people during the interview trail that you keep in contact with and see at meetings and catch up with. So I really think just that close-knit community of colleagues that you have are the people that I go to for asking questions. And that continues to this day. And I'm sure it will continue until the end of career because things happen, things change in how we manage patients, new technologies emerge. So it's just a continual learning experience, which I think most of us love about medicine. So.
No, that's great to hear. You know, sometimes when there's job opportunities, you might be coming out of fellowship and be the only recon person. And so I know I've heard people try to consider whether or not they think that they can either, that's the right place for them at that point in their career, whether it's better to be somewhere where there's a senior mentor available. So that's kind of why I was asking the question.
I think because I went to Chicago kind of, it was verging on mid-career. I'd been in practice for 4 years already. And it was a perfect opportunity for me to start a microvascular program in a place that did not have one and really learn a lot about reconstruction because, you know, not all the time do we receive a patient with the anticipated defect that we had discussed. And so it really challenged me to just grow in terms of how am I going to put this patient back together with both form and function. that was actually fun for me. And that I don't think that would have been the case had that been the setting of my first opportunity out of fellowship. But everyone's not the same. So that challenge might have been welcomed by somebody else when they just finished fellowship. And it, a lot also has to do with just the system that you're in, not just your partners, but the system itself. Like, how much are they willing to give and help your practice grow? If you need XYZ instrument, for example, if you need a set of beds in the ICU designated for a particular group of nurses that are going to take care of your flaps. Like, there's so many things that go into microvascular reconstruction that occur outside of the operating room. It's the whole gamut, I think. So you would really have to be a good judgment of all of those factors in taking that kind of job right out of fellowship, I think.
I think Larissa kind of brings up a really important point in that all four of us, I think, are in some different version of practice setting in terms of your partners, the level of seniority of your partners, if you even have partners and their experience and stuff like that. Question for you, or I guess a question for all three of you. When you're thinking about when you're first starting your practice, or you're a young head and neck surgeon that's also trying to build your microvascular practice, how do you strike the balance of you're the young person, you're coming in there and you want to say yes to everything, you want to do everything, you're like, I'm open to do anything and everything that you need, and you're kind of now leaning back on maybe some previous skills from residency where you're doing a combination of skull base and endoscopic work and recon, et cetera. You know, how do you kind of start an institution with open arms, but then kind of target yourself even early in your career to build the practice that you want and also have longevity within your practice where if you do need to leave for some amount of time or have a child or whatever, you don't feel like, oh, I just said I would do all these things and now I need to leave for a short amount of time. And, you know, you kind of lose all that goodwill that you built or kind of lose the practice that you built. How do you find that balance and also not really burn out while trying to stay busy early on?
I think it's so important to be highly organized and adhere to, well, there's a couple of things. We are very organized medical students, right? We probably, all of us, had some kind of study schedule where it was color-coded and it had times and dates of what you were going to accomplish. And it just pertained to what you were tackling in medical school. As time has passed and obviously beyond fellowship, I have found that it really helps me on Saturday morning with my cup of coffee to sit down with my calendars. And for the week, I am planning everything that I'm doing every day. And that does not just pertain to work. I have everything written with respect to exercise, doctor's appointments, anything and everything, so that nothing is missed. And so that I can look at my calendar. And if somebody asks me if I can do something, I can say yes, or I can say no. And I don't feel guilty about that anymore. I used to, but I do not. Second, I think it is highly important when you are accepting additional roles to consider, do you actually enjoy this? Because obviously, if you enjoy whatever responsibility you're adding to your plate, you're going to do it with vigor. You're going to do it really well. You're not going to be begrudging of that experience, as opposed to, oh, this potentially has some impact on my career, because I think everything will have an impact on your career as long as you do it well. So I think it's important to recognize what you enjoy. Now, caveat is, if your chairman asks you to do something, you obviously do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the advice I was given out of fellowship is kind of that you have to say yes to everything in the beginning. You have to be available, and you have to, you know, just start building relationships and building a reputation. And then, you know, a few years out, you can start to tailor it. Now, what the best way to navigate that is, I'm not sure. My chairman asked me specifically if there was an area that I wanted to focus on at our like last annual meeting. So that made it easier for me to make sure that we were all on the same page. I don't know that all chairmen do that.
I think, you know, the questions or the requests, I mean, they seem to grow exponentially. They don't really grow linearly. I feel like, you know, each year I get more requests and, you know, more demands on my time and attention. And I think pretty quickly you have to kind of phase out of that mode of saying yes to everything, or you'll really burn yourself out.
Yeah. Another great piece of advice I got from Frank Cervantes was that, I don't even know if he ever did this. He said, once a quarter, you need to take time for yourself, whether that is a 3-day long weekend or you have a scheduled vacation. Like Frank Cervantes, I cannot recall that he did that, but it is a great piece of advice. I think just to remember to plan time periods where you are just away from the job, disconnected, so that you can recharge and get back to everything with the renewed spirit that it takes to do what we do. Probably none of us do that, huh?
So I'm just curious, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about you found your threshold, you know, you really kind of set your limit. You don't want to do more than 2 flaps in a week. What has it taken for you to kind of keep up the free flap practice, kind of the demands of that, just, you know, physically, emotionally, being able to do that from week to week? And I guess, can you tell us a little bit about how you found that limit and kind of how that affected you?
I think I found the limit just in that time period where I was doing 3 a week. And again, it was probably 4 to 6 months that occurred. And it was not at the beginning of my career, but it took a significant toll in terms of just my emotional state, which in retrospect probably meant I was burnt out. And I think probably just recognizing that I was not feeling as excited about going to work and tackling those problems and having some not so good patient outcomes made me realize that really my threshold was 2 a week. I think that we spend so much time in preparation for our cases, both emotionally and technically, that when something doesn't go well, it's really devastating. There's no other word for it. It's like, you know, I hate to compare cancer to death of a flap, but I mean, honestly, when you experience that with your patient, it's a similar experience, basically, from my perspective. And so I think just recognizing that I needed help, as in another surgeon, was probably how I arrived that 2 I can do, 3 not so much. And then asking for that from, you know, your chairman.
So what advice would you give to a junior head and neck surgeon who, in terms of how you handle that disappointment, that, you know, devastation of losing a flap or having a bad outcome or patient death? What kind of advice do you have? Because, I mean, these are high stakes surgeries. I mean, you know, when a flap doesn't go the way that you plan, I mean, it can be devastating for the patient, the family, as well as you as the surgeon.
I think a lot about conversations that you have with your peers and trying not to take the job home with you, and then really having an outlet. So for me, the outlet's running, exercise. Again, for me, the conversations happen with your community of colleagues. And, you know, I've been in this situation most of my career where it's just been me as the microvascular person and resection surgeon. So the other person not really understanding the microvascular aspect of what we're doing. But that being said, they can most definitely relate to a cancer patient not doing so well. So that's how I arrived at that comparison. I just think that, as you said, it's devastating for not only the patient, but the patient's family, and then obviously you as well. So I think as time has gone by, I've gotten better with respect to even sharing my emotions with the family. Is actually helpful to not just me, but them. And so I think just being open and honest about what's happening has helped me deal with that better. it's never going to be easy. If it is easy, then we're not doing the right thing. Probably.
So there's a lot of different studies that have looked at gender in terms of advocating, not, you know, not just for salary, but for other things. Like women are just in general less likely to ask for a raise, less likely to ask for something. Any advice you have for both females and young faculty members in terms of advocating for themselves?
Sure. I think when I've learned that in advocating for something, I try to state the current status of what is happening, and I try to provide evidence as to why what I'm asking for is not only important, but beneficial to the system, so that I'm demonstrating that there is in fact a benefit, and also try to give an overview of what the future will look like if you give me what I'm asking for in terms of not just productivity, but overall, how is this benefiting the system? So I think when I advocate for something, I try to have a present and where we can be.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I was thrown right into it fairly early on when I had to ask for a $2.5 million robot.
Yes. I did the same thing. I got my robot.
I did too.
So I guess I'll throw them out there. We're kind of bouncing all over the place, but I feel like that's what's nice about doing these podcasts. Some people may be interested in one part and we'll do something else. To go back to talking about, you know, when you lose a flap, as a head and neck surgeon who's not done his first flap, I'm very anxious about that concept as an attending. I always found that, you know, my senior mentors and stuff, for them, the N is so high. So then when you're quoting these percentages, the percentages make sense. It's one out of whatever, 100, 200, thousands, et cetera. You know, when you're a young attending and you only have so few cases and you kind of go through your first whatever group of months or years and you start kind of looking at your outcomes and how your patients did, at what point in time are you kind of chalking it up to the, like Anders was saying, like a high stakes game? And at what point in time are you really kind of thinking, you know, is this a system thing? Is this a personal thing? Is this the choice of the patient that you're operating on? Because I find that sometimes when we talk about cases in IQI or M&M, there's sometimes the discussion of, oh, this is very kind of patient specific factor, physician specific factor, et cetera. And when you're early on, I feel like you can't help but just think, oh, well, kind of just started doing this, so it has to be on me for you know, why something goes wrong or you missed something or maybe didn't have the outcome you were expecting.
We are the hardest on ourselves with respect to anything. That's why I think when you have a bad outcome or undesirable outcome, if you're discussing it with your community of colleagues, they will help you recognize that this was not your fault. And they'll also help you recognize, oh, you could have tried this or thought about this. I think early on, the best advice I ever got was you want to sort of choose the chip shots so that you're working the kinks that you might not know about in your system out. Like if you're doing a radial forearm flap for oral tongue and there's something that happens postoperatively because the nurses aren't accustomed to what you're doing, it's obviously an opportunity for you to educate and after you've identified where the systemic problems are. So if you do a couple of chip shot cases, that helps you build those relationships with those that are caring for your patients afterward, and then begin your more challenging cases where you know that intraoperatively, you're probably going to have more challenges than your regular case. So choosing your cases wisely initially is probably the best thing to do. And you can also help preempt some things on the pre-surgical side by having conversations like this patient might have this airway issue postoperatively because their stoma is not going to be the typical stoma, for example. I think communication and building relationships early on is helpful in that regard. And then I don't think you're ever going to lose the pre-evaluation and workup that you're doing in your planning of your reconstructive flap. So you are, I mean, it's kind of cliche, but you are always going to be prepared because you've done all of this work. You haven't done it for no reason. I don't think that there's going to be a lack of preparation. So really it's in identifying what went wrong during a case potentially. And that just requires a lot of self introspection when you do have a bad outcome. I try to learn from every single case, and that's happening for me right now because I have done micro, and now I have another partner who does the micro. So now I'm doing ablative work again. And for me, that's challenging. It's been a long time. And I hate feeling terrible that I have not achieved an R0 resection or that I have injured the vein that my partner wants to use, you know? So I think that it's important to always have some introspection after every single operative experience, because you can always find something that you can probably improve.
Yeah, and I think that's in our nature. You know, we really want to look at those things that didn't go so well and try to learn from them so that you can do better the next time. Arvin, one of these days, I'll have to show you my my first case at KU, which I did not resect. That was handed to me by one of my senior partners. You don't always get those chip shots when you're first starting, so I hope right. I hope for your sake you do.
Me too.
All right. Well, great. I really appreciate your insights, Dr. Jefferson, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We enjoyed it.
Yeah, really fun.